Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
We'll be in chapter 18 today, which is the beginning of the trials under the Jewish authorities and the Roman authorities. There is much confusion in the synoptics as exactly to the order of the events that occur. There is an excellent resource book out that I think you would really enjoy seeing. This is Roman Society and Roman Law in the New Testament by Sherwin-White, an Englishman. You'll really enjoy this, and I hope if you haven't seen this book, you'll get it. This one, it deals with most of the issues about the Roman government. The Gospels, Paul, Acts, deals with Luke and that very difficult historical reference with Cyrenius. And I hope you'll get that book. It really be helpful to you. Now, let's look then if we could. John's going to leave some things out that you're accustomed to seeing in the other synoptics of this account. And I must admit to you, it's hard to know exactly what the order is because they differ slightly. To me, that says they are eyewitness accounts more than a mechanical unity. Now, I hope it doesn't bother you much because it's here and we can't do anything about it. Notice where it says, on saying these things, he went with his disciples across. Now, my translation has the ravine of cedars. It's the wadi of Kedron. Now, this ravine of cedars seems to come from the Septuagint translation of 2 Samuel 15:23. But there were no cedars in Jerusalem in Jesus' day that we know of. So the brook Kedron is better. Kedron seems to mean black. Now, it may be black because into the Kedron was where all the blood from the sacrifice was drained. And in the summertime, there was no water there. In the wintertime, it was a free-flowing little creek. And so maybe it's the darkness that the blood turned the water. I really don't know, but it should be the Kedron instead of the ravine of cedars. To a place where there was a garden. Now, John completely leaves out Jesus' agony in Gethsemane. He records they went to a garden. He records the arrest. But he does not go into the account of the prayer agony of Jesus saying, Father, this cup pass from me. Because John's whole purpose has been Jesus' calmness and control of every situation. And so he leaves this out for his own purposes. I'm sure he knew the other ones were there. The parallels would be Matthew 26:36, Mark 14:32. Gethsemane means oil press. And apparently this was a very common place for Jesus to go, as we see from verse 2 and also from Luke 22:39. From Luke 21:37, we know this is where Jesus slept or bivouacked during the last week of his life. And so he apparently slept in this garden, and that's where Judas knew where he could be found. Now, and he went into it with his disciples. Now, Judas, too, who was in the process of betraying him, knew the spot because Jesus had often met the disciples there. Now, Judas got together the Roman garrison and some attendants from the high priest and the Pharisees. Now, this Roman garrison was the purpose that the Jews went to the Romans. They probably said, there's going to be a riot. We need your help to arrest this conspirator. They wanted the Romans involved because they want to kill Jesus. They also don't trust the temple police who have already blown one arrest attempt in chapter 7, verse 44. So now it's the Roman cohort. Now, how many there were, we don't know. This originally meant 600 soldiers. I don't think 600 soldiers went. It's used quite often for 200 soldiers. Maybe 200 went. There is a large group of armed men out to capture one man because they think he's an insurrectionist. Jerusalem has swelled to three times her Norman size because of the Passover. They think there's going to be a riot, and they took every precaution. Okay? Now, the temple police apparently went. Notice it says, with lanterns and torches and weapons. Now, the lanterns and torches seem to mean lanterns like the olive oil lanterns. But in this context, they're probably synonymous. They were well prepared in case Jesus hid or in case they were attacked in the dark. They would have... Now, it just has weapons here, but we learn from other passages where there were swords and clubs. Now, the swords would be what the Roman soldiers carried, and the clubs what the temple police carried. Okay? Now, and Jesus, as he knew everything, that's a very strong point. Friends, he knew it was going to happen, and he goes out to meet it. That was going to befall him, came forward and asked, who is it that you're looking for? Came out of the dark, right in front of him, in the light of the torches, and said, who do you want? And they said, we want Jesus of Nazareth. Now, there's been a lot of discussion about does it mean Nazarene or from Nazareth. There is some etymological questions here, but it seems the usage in the New Testament backs up from the city of Nazareth, not Nazarene. Now, and Jesus said, I am. Now, your translation may say, I am he, but it is the very emphatic, I am, which is the covenant name from God from Exodus 3:14. And Jesus has asserted that he is God several times by this very same technique. You might want to see chapter 8, verse 58, and chapter 13, verse 19. For a Jewish audience, this would have affirmed that he claimed to be deity. And you're going to see how the crowd acts. Now, the Jewish soldiers should not have recognized this. It's kind of a Jewish play on words. But they were caught up in the impressive nature of Jesus. And look what happens to them. And Judas, who betrayed him, was standing among them. Now, it does not mention the kiss of Judas. All three other synoptic gospels mention it. John does not. So when he had said to them, I am, it's mentioned three times for emphasis, they took a lurch backwards and fell to the ground. Now, I don't know what happened, but Jesus was very impressive in the power of his personality. And this whole group of soldiers, 200, 300, I don't know how many, 50, I don't know, fell backwards. Now, man, that's a pretty powerful personality. And so once more he asked them, who is it that you are looking for? They said, Jesus of Nazareth. He said, I've already told you I am he. Now, maybe the emphasis here is because he did not want the disciples caught up in this arrest attempt. He says, you don't need my disciples. You're looking for me. You said you're looking for me twice. And so let them go. It's an aorist imperative. And maybe it's to fulfill the prophecy from chapter 16, 32 that they would all flee and forsake him. I'm not sure. This he said that the statement that he had made might be fulfilled. And that's what we're referring to. I have not lost one of them except those who have given me. And that, of course, is from chapter 17, verse 12. And the ideal about them all scattering is 16:32. Now, and so, verse 10. So Simon Peter, who had a sword, drew it, struck the high priest's servant's ear, and cut it off, his right ear. His name was Malchus. Now, friends, Peter, they say Peter is a chicken and he's a coward. Friends, in the face of 200 soldiers, there were only two swords in the apostolic band. Peter had one of them. In the face of all those soldiers, Peter drew that sword and was ready to fight. Somebody said he tried to cut the ear off. Cut the ear off, nothing. He tried to split that dude's skull open and missed and cut his ear off. Now, Jesus put it back on. You think that impressed him? Man, I tell you what. Now, I think the reason he did this was probably, if you look at Luke 22, 36 through 38, you might get the background of why Peter acted this way. It's a note of Peter's faith. He was sure he was going to die in the fight, but he was ready to fight. Now, then Jesus said to Peter, put your sword back into your sheath. I must not drink the cup which the Father has handed me? It's saying a question, but with an affirmation. Now, this idea of a cup is a synonym or a symbol in the Old Testament for a man's destiny. Let me give you a few good references. There are many. Psalm 75:8, Isaiah 51:17 and 22. So John just does not bring into here the agony that Jesus felt, but accentuates the positive. Now, in verses 12 and following, the trial before the Jewish authorities differs with the synoptics. There's a good chapter on this book I've showed you by Sherman White, and I hope you'll look at that. So the garrison, its commander, and the attendants of the Jews arrested Jesus, put him in handcuffs. Apparently they were not afraid of him. This was just standard operating procedure. And took him first to Annas. Now we see that verse 24 helps us a whole lot. And some of the ancient manuscripts, well, one of them, I believe it's Sinaiticus, puts verse 24 right here, which really solves all the problems. But you wonder why all the manuscripts of John everywhere else have it in the order we have it. The order in John is somewhat different. Jesus is going to go before Annas. He is going to go before Caiaphas. Then he's going to go before Pilate. And these things are somewhat slightly confusing in the other accounts. Now, Annas was the high priest. His son-in-law was Caiaphas. We know that several of his sons were high priests. This was a position that was meant to be a lifelong and passed on to your sons, supposed to be Levites only, you know, descendants of Aaron. But it came to be a political plum that was purchased from the Romans. And the Sadducees, wealthy Sadducean families, had bought it and kind of stayed in their family, and it was passed every several years to another. It was the people who owned the concessions in the temple area. I think because Jesus cleansed the temple twice, this man really wanted to see the one who had the audacity to do that. And so they take him first to the power behind the throne, which was with Annas. He was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was high priest that year. This particular year that Jesus died is what it means. Now it was Caiaphas who had advised the Jews that it was for their welfare that one should die for the people. John remembers that as a prophecy and puts it in here. Now you might want to see verse 24, for the trial before Caiaphas. That's not recorded in John. Now you might say, how did John know what happened at the trial at Annas? Well, apparently John was there. Now why he was there, I don't know. Let's go and look at verse 15. Simon Peter and another disciple followed on after Jesus, and that other disciple was acquainted with the high priest, and so went in with Jesus into the high priest's courtyard. Now this word acquaintance means far more than just someone who you knew slightly. This means an intimate acquaintance. You might want to see Luke 2:44 and Luke 23:49. Now, we don't know, but there's been a lot of conjecture here. This same little phrase, the other disciple, is used in chapter 20 in several verses to describe John himself. And many think that this is John that's referring to himself, but in humility without using his name. And there's a lot of speculation about his mother's name is Salome, and maybe she's a sister of Mary, and maybe that means he was a Levite and possibly a priest, and a lot of speculation that we can't back up, really. Some say that he was the son of Zebedee, and Zebedee had a large business of selling fish, and maybe he knew the high priest because he sold fish to the high priest's family, or maybe they bought fish from them to sell. We don't know. We just don't know. There's another speculation that maybe we're talking about Joseph of Arimathea or Nicodemus here. We're just not certain. So the tradition has been John the Apostle, but a real possibility is Joseph or Nicodemus, and maybe we just have no idea, and we have to leave it at that. Now, but Peter stood outside before the door. So the other disciple, who was acquainted with the high priest, stepped out and spoke to the woman doorkeeper and brought Peter in. Peter couldn't even get in the courtyard without the other disciple saying, "Let him in. He's okay." Then the servant girl at the door said to Peter, "You too are one of this man's disciples, aren't you?" Now, the question expects a no answer, so it really wasn't a challenge. You know, I think Peter was all set to answer the questions and be put on trial, but this little slave girl caught him off guard, and he said, "Oh, no, I'm not him." The first fulfilled prophecy about this. Now, and he answered, "No, I'm not." Because it was cold, the slaves and the attendants, slaves of the high priest, the temple police who were there, made a charcoal fire and were standing about warming themselves. It was apparently cold, so Peter got up there close, and he was warming himself. In the light of the fire, they said, "Hey, you are one of them, aren't you?" But now, in this particular account, the questioning of Jesus before Ananias breaks in between the first and second denials of Peter. Now, the high priest questioned Jesus about his disciples. Now, the high priest, some say this is Caiaphas, but he's mentioned in verse 24. It seems to be Anna still. Now, about his disciples and his teachings. It seems unusual he asked about his disciples before his teachings. But this man was worried about the influence of Jesus, and so that may be why it fits. So Jesus answered him, "I've spoken publicly, haven't kept any secrets. Why are you asking me? Everything I've said publicly." And one of the guys who was standing there thought he was insulting the way he was speaking and slapped him across the face. Now, the word originally meant hit with a rod, but the usage in Jesus' day meant to slap open-handed in the face, and it seems to be fulfilled prophecy of Isaiah 50, verse 6. Now, it says, "Is this the way you answer the high priest?" And Jesus looked at him and said, "Fella, if I've said anything untrue, you tell me what it is. If I haven't said anything untrue, why do you slap me?" Because you see what Jesus had said. He said, "Mr. High Priest, you're not conducting this according to law. And don't you think you ought to do it right?" For this night trial was absolutely illegal. And Jesus was saying, this is not the way you're supposed to introduce evidence. And so Jesus said, "If I've said something wrong, you tell me what it is. If not, you tell me why you struck me." Well, I tell you what. Now, look at verse 23. They're both first-class conditional sentences. They're true. Look at verse 24. So Anna sent him over, still in handcuffs, to Caiaphas, the high priest. We don't have the record of Caiaphas. Apparently, Caiaphas was with the whole Sanhedrin, and it went directly from Caiaphas to Pilate, and that seems to be the order. Simon Peter still stood warming himself, and so they said to him. Now, there's a real divergence here among the different accounts. Mark says that the maid who first asked him the question asked him again. Mark 14:69. But Matthew says another servant girl asked him. Matthew 26:71. But Luke 22:58 says a man asked him. Now apparently what's happened is some person would ask, and everybody around the fire would say, "Yeah, what about that? Well, yeah, what about that?" And so it's eyewitness account. I think John was there. Obviously, Peter was there. That's the Gospel of Mark. How Luke found out who he's using, I just don't know. Now, let's see then. Verse 26. One of the high priest slaves, who was a kinsman of the one whose ear Peter had cut off, family deal, "I did not see you in the garden." Now, this question implies a yes. So the questioning is getting serious now. And here Peter denies it. Now we learn from Mark 14:71 and Matthew 26:74 that he denied it with a curse. And it's imperfect. So then the cock crowed. Now it's unusual about a cock crowing because it's very early in the morning. I think it's about 3 or 4 o'clock. First place, that's unusual, a rooster crowing that early. And second, the Jews would not allow chickens in the city of Jerusalem because they dirtied the place up. So it was a Roman chicken living next door. I don't know. But it certainly fulfills the prophecy. In Luke 22:61, it says Jesus looked at Peter. Now, some people have ascertained that maybe Annas and Caiaphas lived in the same house. And when the guards were moving him from the quarters of Annas to the quarters of Caiaphas is when Jesus looked at Peter. Now, this is all supposition. We don't know how to get around the differences of these accounts. It's all supposition, and we're simply not sure how they all fit together. Now, in verse 28 and following is the account about the trial before Pilate. They took Jesus before Caiaphas to the governor's palace. This is the praetorium, which meant any part of the governor's residence. Now, he had a part that was done for official judging called the bema. He had a part of informal meeting people. Exactly where this took place, we're not sure. Some say it was done at the Fortress Antonio. Some say it was done at Herod's palace. There's some discrepancy there. We're not real sure. This was the temporary residence of the Roman procurator because he normally lived in Caesarea Philippi, not in Jerusalem. It was early in the morning. We know from historical records that the Romans held court at daybreak. So I think this must have happened very close to daybreak to try to give some semblance of legality to the Jewish trial with the Sanhedrin and to immediately get to Pilate before any other cases could get there, because we're coming up on a special holy day, you know, of the high holy day of Passover Sabbath. Now, they didn't go inside. They made Pilate come outside. Notice it says that so they'd be unfit to eat the Passover supper in verse 28. Now, this is the traditional controversy about the difference between John's timing and the synoptics. The synoptics say that the Last Supper was the Passover meal. John says that they were afraid to defile themselves for the Passover meal. And in John 19:14, it says the day of preparation. And there's been some real fight over that, and I'm not sure I can solve the problem. It just seems that John says it happened a day earlier. So the synoptics say it happened the day of the Passover. Now, which it is, I'm not certain. They didn't want to go into Pilate's house because it would defile them from the rest of the ceremonies of Passover week and unleavened bread. But didn't that surprise you, a little irony? They don't mind having judicial, unfair murder, but it bothers them. They might be ceremonially unclean. Just sounds like us and our nitpicking rules, doesn't it? So Pilate came outside. That blessed the Romans that the Jews wouldn't come in their residences because they thought they were unclean. So Pilate came outside and asked, "What charge bring this man?" And the whole crowd retorted, the crowd of Jewish Sanhedrin, temple police, "If he were not a criminal, we would not have turned him over to you." Well, that was kind of a snotty reply. They were saying they didn't have a real charge. We know from the other Gospels they charged him with blasphemy. But they're going to charge him insurrection with the Romans because the Romans wouldn't try blasphemy and they want Jesus killed. So they say, "Well, if he wasn't a bad guy, an evildoer, we wouldn't have brought him here." And Pilate's not going to take that. Pilate said to them, "Well, take him yourselves and try him in a court with your own law." He knew there wasn't a specific charge, or they wouldn't be acting like that. Then the Jews said to him, the Jews here mean the religious authority, that's how John uses that phrase, "It is not lawful for us to execute the death penalty on anyone." Now, it's obvious from several passages that Jesus knew he was going to be crucified, not stoned. Stone was how the Jews dealt with the blasphemer. Romans crucified. Now, the reason for that is Deuteronomy 21:23, where it says, "Anyone who hangs on a tree is cursed." And the Jews want Jesus of Nazareth cursed by God, so they want Roman crucifixion. Now, to back that up, you ought to see chapter 3, verse 14, chapter 8, verse 28, and chapter 12, verses 32 and 33. "For they wanted Jesus crucified so that curse would become." Now, that curse is exactly what bothered Paul about Jesus. How can God's Messiah be cursed by God? But that is the truth of the gospel. In the book of Galatians, he took our curse on himself. And that's the idea of him dying for our sins. Now, notice if you would where it says, verse 32, this indicated what sort of death he was to die. And that certainly does. "So Pilate went back into his praetorium, government house, and called Jesus and asked him, 'Are you the king of the Jews?' Now, the Jews had accused him of blasphemy, and that was their charge, that he tried to be the Messiah. They structured it in such a way as to call him the king of the Jews, which would imply treason to a Roman who did not understand the implications of the messiahship the Jews were really worried about. You might want to see Luke 23:2. "And Jesus answered him, 'Do you ask me this of your own initiative, or have others suggested it to you about me?'" Well, what Jesus was trying to say, if you as a Roman are asking me, am I a threat to you? Am I a king in the sense of an insurrection against Rome? No. But if the Jews have said this to you, and you're asking me if I am the Jewish Messiah, then yes, I certainly am. Well, Pilate didn't understand all this. He just says, "I'm not a Jew, am I? I don't understand what you're talking about, all this Jewish technicalities. I just want to know, are you a king?" Now, that's the whole input here. Jesus said, "My kingdom, it does not belong to this world." Now, here is a standoff between the supreme earthly power of Rome and the spiritual kingdom of Jesus. And they confront here, and it's obvious. If my kingdom did belong to this world, my attendants would be fighting, imperfect tense. Now, in Matthew 26:53, it might refer to angels. Here it seems to mean followers. I don't know which would be the best. Now, Pilate said to him, "So you are the king of the Jews then?" Irony here. Jesus answered, "Certainly I'm a king. You've said it. And this is the very purpose I was born." Perfect passive. "For this very purpose I've come into the world." Jesus acknowledged his sense of preexistence and purpose, and the sense that he knew he was going to die, but it was in the will of God. That's what he's saying to Pilate. Now, Pilate just says, "What is truth?" But Pilate did not really want an answer, for Pilate just walks off. What Pilate wanted to know was not some religious question about is Jesus or Jewish Messiah and what Jewish Messiah means. He wanted to know if this guy was a threat to the Roman Empire. And he had adduced that he was not. So he's going to try to let him go. So he's going to walk out to the crowd again. He says, "I can find no charge against him." John, written toward the end of the first century, is trying to show that Christianity is not a threat to the Roman government. That's what the Gospel of Luke and Acts is all about. And here in John's the same thing. Pilate did not condemn Jesus. It was the Jewish leaders. Pilate was forced to it by the mob. Jesus never was a threat to the Roman authorities. Paul was never a threat to the Roman authorities, even made friends with them. And that's what the Gospel was trying to say to the Roman people of the first century. Christianity is not a threat to you. And no Roman official has ever been really dogmatic against Christianity. Except, of course, Domitian and later Nero. I mean, Nero and later Domitian. So that's the purpose of this whole dialogue, I think, is why John fits it. And at this time, we learn from the other Gospels, there was a tradition that one prisoner be let loose during Passover. Pilate thought they'd let loose Jesus. Now, the mob that was there knew about this, and maybe they'd been waiting for Barabbas. Now, isn't this irony? We learn from several passages. Let me see if I can find one of them here. I have them down. Mark 15:7, that Barabbas, son of a rabbi, son of the father, something like that, was a real insurrectionist. He had killed people in rebelling against Rome. The very charge that Jesus was accused of, they're going to let the man go who was guilty. And Jesus, who isn't guilty, they're going to crucify in his place. Isn't that irony? Well, you see, I think that mob was not only whipped up by the religious leaders, but I think that mob was there for the very purpose of trying to get released a local folk hero. Barabbas would have been well known in Jerusalem. He'd have been kind of a local hero because of his hatred of the Romans and his activity. And maybe it was not so much they hated Jesus. That, now, of course, the Jewish leaders wanted that. But I think the crowd really wanted Barabbas and were so pro-Barabbas they just didn't care about Jesus. Now, that's just a theory. I'm not real sure, because what follows is an amazing, amazing display of injustice and unfairness in the light of the Jewish officials knowing it's not right and the Roman officials knowing it's not right and Jesus not even defending himself. I hope you'll get this book about the Roman law, because it'll really clarify some things to you. I hope you'll read all four Gospels and try in your own mind to put kind of a loose order or agenda of what's going to happen. Just as we cannot make a full agenda of the last week of Jesus' life, known as the Passion Week, we cannot make a full and complete and dogmatic agenda of the series of trials. But it is obvious what is happening. An attempt is made to railroad Jesus. And for whatever political or personal or religious motives, that occurred. But the Bible says that that was the predetermined plan of God. It was not just an unfortunate happening. It was not just injustice. Jesus, in Mark 10:45, said, "I came to give my life a ransom for many." The sinless one came to die for sinless mankind. Him dying on a cross apparently is very important from Deuteronomy 21:23. Friends, this is not a happenstance. This is the way that God chose to redeem mankind, by coming a man himself, being unfairly condemned, being brutally killed. Hallelujah, praise be unto God, bursting out of the grave on Easter morning. I've enjoyed being with you, and I'll see you again, same time, same place, next week.